America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Well, strange stuff going on in Iowa. Hillary apparently not leaving a tip, turning into a big snafu. Basically, it's a dead heat. I hate this horse race stuff. That's the name of the blog over at CBS. Horse race. In a dead heat with John Edwards and Barack Obama. Ultimately, I suppose for the Iowans, in the caucuses, it gets down to electability. It's going to be an interesting one to watch. And Mike Huckabee creeping up on Mitt Romney. Strange stuff going on. Strange stuff going on. Welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. In our first hour, we're going to talk about the new conservative coalition. Thomas Edsel is going to be with us in just a second. In our second hour, the 50-year strategy for a new progressive era. Is that possible? Simon Rosenberg about that. And in our third hour, we're going to get into all things political and just the general news of the day. What's the deal with the Justice Department reopening the wireless warrant tap inquiry that was halted by Bush? Why was Gonzo not there at the Mukasey signing or swearing? There's some interesting things going on out there in the world. But to begin, Thomas Edsel is with us. Thomas is the author of a new book, Building Red America, the New Conservative Coalition and the Drive for Permanent Power. He also is an award-winning journalist. And in fact, I think you're the, aren't you the political editor over at Huffington Post now?
I am now, yes.
So, congratulations on that, too.
Thanks.
And many other things that you've done. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Thank you. In your book, you talk about how Republicans over the last 40 years have really dominated American politics. I think of Republicans as having dominated American politics largely since 1980, since the election of Reagan. Why do you go back before that?
I think if you look starting in 1968 with Nixon's victory, and in 72, he wins again. Carter very briefly holds office for one term in 1976. And to a certain extent, it's really a fluke of Watergate. And then the Republicans are back in power starting in 1980, continuing with the Clinton years as the exception, to 2008. So I think the conservative revolution as such began with Barry Goldwater. That was a total landslide defeat, but then it recouped and became, I think Nixon by 1972 had put together the conservative coalition that we've seen operating ever since then.
Right, and you're suggesting in your book that this is a significant force that America has been under the sway of and is going to have to deal with for a long, long time. And it, by the way, I'd add anecdotally, it seems to me that Bill Clinton, with his, the era of big government is over, was not so far out of line from, the mainstream Republicanism anyway, not necessarily the hard right agenda. In, the reform of welfare, NAFTA, GATT, the Telecommunications Act, all these things. What's your take? Was the Clinton administration really a continuation of the Republican rule, but just not in name only?
I think it was a Democratic accommodation to a lot of the trends that the conservative movement had captured. And it was, in a certain sense, an attempt to co-opt part of that while still retaining a commitment to the Democratic Party.
Right.
Right now, the Democratic Party looks like it's going to do very well in 2008. And Bush has really been a terrible factor for the Republican Party and the conservative coalition. The one point I try to make in the book, though, is that the Republican Party has had disasters, had the disaster of 1964, it had the disaster of Watergate, Iran-Contra, the Clinton impeachment, shutting down government, all these things that were really horror shows for the GOP, but each time it has come back. And for those who think that now is sort of the new era of the progressive movement. It may be, but they should not discount the ability of the Republican Party and the conservative movement to make a comeback.
Yeah, I get the sense that if we're looking at a repeat of history, it would be the early part of the 19th century, of the 20th century rather, where you know you had a semi-progressive or progressive in Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican of all things, and then running in the Bull Moose Party, and there was this period of time that looked like the country was going progressive, and then we kind of swung back to the right again, and the Republicans held power really until the Republican Great Depression.
Yes, they held it all the way from 1898 through 1932 with that one progressive blip, in a sense.
Yeah, and you could probably even go back into to Reconstruction Grover Cleveland, I guess, was the exception, but. Well, in any case, it's the thing that concerns me so much about this is that this is a coalition which is held together ostensibly with bubble gum and rubber bands. I mean, you know, you've got the gun fringe, the abortion fringe, the religious fringe, and in large part, from what I get of your book, the anti fringe, the anti-black fringe, the anti-Latino fringe, the anti-gay fringe, you know, the racist bunch, the fearful bunch. That seems to be like the coalition that's holding it together on the ground, and yet at the core of it is a group of very powerful, very wealthy, very determined, and very entrenched interests, persons, and institutions. Is that a reasonable overview?
Well, I think that what you have is a coalition that is held together to some extent by being anti-government, as you say, especially the role of government in civil rights and in women's rights, but also the role of government as a tax collector and as a regulator of the business community. Basically, the business community has been able to find allies among a number of groups who share this view of government as now being intrusive or imposing a liberal agenda. And it's been a very coherent and effective coalition. How long it's going to last is the big question, and I think the demographic trends are that it's going to be problematic for the Republican Party because, one, there is a growing acceptance of all the rights revolutions that occurred in the 60s and 70s, and secondly, there is this rise of the Hispanic electorate and the growth of what you might call the creative class in the suburbs and central cities of people who work on the internet and in high tech and in the professions.
Mm-hmm. Although I can tell you, being in radio, one of the interesting phenomena that a lot of us are noticing is there is an explosion of Spanish language Rush Limbaughs all around the country, and many of them are financed externally. They're on
really?
Stations where
yeah.
they're buying time, and right wing Hispanic talk radio is starting to grow, and you know this is. These guys plan long term. I mean,
yep.
it's just like, you know, the progressive era, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, the trust buster, and he took them on and he, you know, did the talk and did the walk, but in the end, you know, they came down on him, or, you know, they came back. I mean, we're talking about entrenched power and entrenched money. I mean, even right through Franklin Roosevelt, I mean, you know, there was a coup attempt against him and Smedley Butler blew the whistle on that thing. So the question, we're talking with Thomas Edsel, and he has a new book out. It's called Building Red America, The New Conservative Coalition and the Drive for Permanent Power. And I'd like to get in, but can you stick around after the break and we can do another 5 or 6 minutes with us?
Sure.
Great, I appreciate that. Because what I'd like to get into with you on this is how does the Democratic Party, how do the Greens, how do progressives, how do Americans, how do unaffiliated voters, how do people who are simply concerned about American values, because it seems like the vast majority of voters really are, actually, when you go issue by issue, how do we deal with this this machine, this Republican machine that you've identified so well in your new book, Building Red America. We're talking with Thomas B. Edsel, and we will be back right after this break. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes. We're seeing things in a different way. God knows it ain't his.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Thomas Edsel. He has a new book called Building Red America, The New Conservative Coalition and the Drive for Permanent Power. And this is actually a very troubling thing here. The idea that the Republicans are setting aside pretty much anything, I mean, that has to do morality is the wrong word. Ideals, whatever. I mean, it's all about power and having a permanent Republican majority, to quote Karl Rove, or to paraphrase. And you're suggesting, Thomas Edsel, that the Republicans have actually accomplished this, that the election of 2006 wasn't the big Democratic victory that it has been touted as, and that anybody who thinks that the Republican Party is going to be going away any day soon is sadly mistaken. Correct me if I'm wrong, first of all, in that setup.
No, I think that's a fair description of what I argue.
And that the Republican Party has been even increasingly ignoring its old mainstream base, you know, my dad's Republicans, you know, the Eisenhower Republicans, the Rockefeller Republicans. It's been ignoring the independent voters, and it's been moving harder and harder to the right. What do the Democrats do about this?
Well, a lot of problems that the Democratic Party and the progressive movement, generally speaking, they're not the same thing, have is that it's much easier to organize and to keep organized interests that have substantial financial interests in the decisions made by the federal government.
Right.
If you take, take cable television. If you argue that cable television now benefits from having monopoly franchises across the country, they are going to fight to protect that as much as they can, whereas consumers who might save, say, $5 each in their costs are going to be very hard to mobilize to reform that system.
Right.
That's true of almost all government benefits. Who has the highest at stake, but basically businesses, corporations, and the very wealthy,
mm-hmm.
where a 2% difference in a tax rate can mean a huge amount of money.
Right. So we're talking really about arguably the top 0.1% of Americans, maybe the top 1% of Americans in terms of their wealth, and probably, you know, the top, 3 or 4% of America's corporations, having concentrated arguably as much as half of the wealth of this country, depending on whose numbers you're looking at, and the Republican Party is their party. And that party has then brought in, you know, I remember, you know, living in Vermont, in rural Vermont, and it used to just amaze me driving by, you know, a little house, a trailer, you know, packed with bales of hay around it to help insulate it in the winter, burning wood, you know, the people making their living, sharpening chainsaws, living on food stamps with Bush for President signs out in front. And this party of the wealthy and powerful has brought them in. How does the Democratic Party take them back?
There has to be a convincing message that their economic future will be significantly improved by Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those people who you say the guy owns a small farm and he's done that, he's worried about his tax burden. He's worried. You somehow have to persuade someone like that that one, the Democrats are not going to raise his taxes to make it a net cost for Democrats coming into office for him and his family, and two, that life will be improved for his children through better educational opportunities, that they will have an opportunity to make a significant living. But it's a pretty
you can't do that on the on deficit spending, though. I mean, you know, we're at $9 trillion deficit. We're probably pushing the boundaries of what we can do without crashing this country. At some point, the Democrats have to go back to FDR's message, which actually worked pretty well, I guess. Although maybe it didn't. I don't know. The Republicans took control of the House and Senate in the election of 46, but go back to FDR's message of we're going to and Teddy Roosevelt's message of we're going to tax the very rich in order to provide these services to create a middle class.
It's a good question. And one of the problems is Tip O'Neill used to say this, that the Democratic Party was too successful in creating a middle class, and basically the middle class is much more tax conscious than the working class. And also tax rates in the past used to have no effect whatsoever on someone who was a blue collar worker. They were exempt, or they fell into a category where there were no increase. They had a base low rate,
and now it's starting to hit them with inflation and everything else.
Yeah,
yeah. It's a fascinating conversation and a fascinating topic. This is an important book: Building Red America, the New Conservative Coalition, and the Drive for Permanent Power. Thomas B. Edsel. Thomas, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. Real pleasure.
Thank you very much. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Your thoughts on the permanent Republican majority right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. We had a great time last night at the Strand. This afternoon at 5:30, I'll be speaking at Demos, a network for ideas in action. It's open to the public. It's at 225th Avenue on the fifth floor. I think that's in the low 20s, as I recall. 23rd or 20-something. Anyway, that's Demos at the 225th Avenue at 5:30 this afternoon. Mark Green's going to be introducing me. And then on Friday, I'll be in San Francisco doing our show from Green 960, from the studios of Green 960. And that afternoon, 3:30 to 6 at the Little Fox Theater in Redwood City. And you can get tickets for that at green960.com if you're listening in San Francisco. On Saturday, I'll be at the Pilgrim's Way Bookstore in Carmel, California, a program that we're doing with KRXA. And on the 29th of November, we'll be in Los Angeles at Barnes & Noble, the 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica. So that's coming down a little down the road. The rest of this is all this week. Over at the Huffington Post, John Zogby has posted a blog that crystallizes things that I have talked about. Those of you who've listened to this program for a long time know that these are issues that I keep coming back to over and over and over again, and I think are so important that, you know, in fact, in the context of Hillary Clinton, in fact, I point out that when Franklin Roosevelt ran for president in 1932, he was not running on a particularly progressive platform. He was running as sort of a middle of the road guy who was just, you know, we'll figure out a way to get out of this, but he wasn't sure what the way was. He didn't so much have a plan. There was no New Deal at this point in the campaign, as Zogby points out. Similarly, and this is, I think, a real good point that John Zogby points out in his blog over at the Huffington Post. At this point in the campaign, when Reagan was running against Jimmy Carter, first of all, nobody thought that Reagan had a chance of winning. He was considered a right-wing nut. And secondly, he had no specific plan. And yet both of these guys, when they came into office, reinvented not only government, but our notion of government. Franklin Roosevelt took us from being a nation that thought government really should have no role in our daily lives and shouldn't, run the army, don't do anything else, to believing that the government could provide a safety net for people and could provide the basis for the creation of a middle class. And in fact, the government did. This is the New Deal brought us the middle class, the modern middle class. Reagan came along and began the deconstruction of that. He redefined federalism, to use Zogby's term, he redefined government, our notion of our relationship to government, as rather than being a positive one, as Franklin Roosevelt had, as being a negative one. And I think John Zogby is so spot on in pointing out that if a Democrat is elected president in this election, and that is an if, and we need to keep that in mind, if a Democrat is elected president, that Democrat is going to have to redefine what that relationship is between we the people and our government, and do it in short order. And in fact, frankly, that would probably be the strongest platform on which to run. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Dan in Manhattan. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today? Dan, you're on the air. Dan is not on the air. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. First, I just want to give an action alert that Congress right now is trying to strip out the solar credits, the energy legislation. So we need to call and say we want solar tax credits.
There you go. Okay, and you can go to callcongress.org, and there's a list of the toll-free phone numbers to call the switchboard in Congress, and you can, if you're not sure even who your representative is, give me your zip code. They'll connect you.
Anyway, the main reason I'm calling is electability. It's been one of the biggest lies, I think, ever passed on to us, especially when we're talking about cosmetics. People win on issues. I mean, just look at the way Ron Paul is getting a surge because of issues.
But he's not going to win.
No, but look at something like Clinton. Clinton won because Ross Perot ran. Had Ross Perot not run, it's very possible that Bush the first would have won. If you look at the less cosmetically appealing people, such as Jimmy Carter, LBJ, they won on the issues, and they won big time. I mean, Carter was competing against the handsome Jerry Brown, the good-looking Frank Church and so forth, but Carter won. And so you look at, he's a short guy, he's, got a big mouth and everything, and has a, thick accent.
Yeah, he's not the Manchurian candidate, the Mitt Romney, the central casting candidate.
But the Democrats have only won.
But let me just push back a little bit on that, Jeff.
Sure.
Carter ran in the aftermath of Watergate, and I think that Thomas Edsel was right in pointing out that might have been an anomaly that had to do with Watergate, with the Republican scandals, as much as anything else.
But also Carter. But if you look at the Democrat. Within the Democrats themselves, Carter ran against three charismatic candidates.
Oh, you're talking in the primaries.
I'm talking about at any level.
Okay.
Yeah, so winning.
Because I'm saying in the primaries, candidates are far more likely to win based on the issues, because primary voters tend to be people who are actually paying attention to the issues. In general elections, in national elections, I do not believe that candidates win based on issues unless they really have a big frame, a really big picture. Roosevelt in his second, third, and fourth terms was running on the issues. And yet, I'd say he was also running on personality.
Look at the landslide victory of LBJ over Goldwater. Goldwater, who could argue that Goldwater is not cosmetically more appealing than LBJ? But it was a landslide victory of LBJ.
The Daisy commercial, Goldwater's speech, extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. People were genuinely afraid that Barry Goldwater was going to throw us into a nuclear war.
It was issues. That's what I'm saying.
I see. Okay.
And so that's the whole point. Democrats have a really, 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 really bad history of winning presidential elections in the last 50 years, especially the last 30. And you can argue the only time we really won was because of Ross Perot.
Well, you can go all the way back to the Civil War. Democrats have a really bad record of winning elections.
Yes. But if we really go for someone who really stands strongly on the issues, I think we would win by a landslide.
Yeah, this is the incredible thing, is that basically you have this party of wealth and power, the Republican Party, which has been so entrenched. I mean, it was actually started as a reform party in 1856 in Jackson, Michigan, And Lincoln ran as a reformer, but it very quickly got co-opted in the 1870s and 1880s. And it's been the party of wealth and power ever since. And there have been a few anomalies. You know, there was Grover Cleveland in the late 1800s and the 1880s. There was arguably, you wouldn't have had Wilson in part, you know, a Democrat in the early part of the 20th century, if it wasn't for the fact that Teddy Roosevelt was on the ticket, splitting the ticket up. And as you point out, Ross Perot split the ticket, there's a lot of Republicans still muttering about that. So, which leaves us with this question. If the Republicans have had, you know, basically a century of mostly exercising the power in this country, and I would argue that they have, to a large extent, with the exception of maybe, you know, 10 years under Roosevelt, then, and the Democrats are 100% where probably 95% of America is at in terms of issues, then what do we do? Answer to that question is we communicate better. But go ahead, Jeff.
Well, the Democrats, we need memes. I mean, since LBJ, can you name a single Democratic program? You can name Head Start. You can name the Great Society. But we've forgotten about titles for things. We know all about No Child Left Behind. Name one Democratic program since the 1960s. You can't do it because they don't have it.
Well, you got and the ones that the Democrats are laying claim to, SCHIP actually was started by a Republican, but it's they haven't bothered to rename it so that it's SCHIP. Well, what? Almost like an obscenity.
Another huge point right now. I'm seeing a really bizarre phenomenon right now. I know people who supported Bush very strongly. They are now a whole bunch of people are saying, you know, I can't vote for any of these candidates, except I had someone actually say this to me. I want Ron Paul, but I'd vote for Kucinich or Edwards. And I'm seeing a number of people saying those are the only three choices to look at, which is really bizarre. And these are Republicans saying that.
Yeah, because they're saying, I want to vote for somebody who actually stands for something.
Yeah, Kucinich is popular. Everybody feels alienated. And those who get to know these candidates.
Yeah.
I mean, I know Democrats who say, hey, I will vote for Ron Paul before Hillary.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing a lot of that.
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot of that as well and seeing a lot of that out there. And it's interesting doing the book tour, the number of people who at almost every one. There was one guy last night, you know, unfortunately, he just started shouting. But at every single book signing I've done over the last, 2 weeks or so that this book has been out, somebody has said, you know, what do you think about Ron Paul? And, you know, I'm hearing a lot of good things about him. What do you think about it? You're right. It's an interesting phenomenon. Really is.
I just had the great honor of meeting Elizabeth Kucinich a few days ago.
She's brilliant, isn't she?
Listening to her on stage for a long time, it's like, I would honestly say since Eugene McCarthy, I've not been so impressed with the candidate and his positions and so forth. I mean, she is saying the same things that he would be saying.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's like the first time I really feel heartfelt that we've got a real candidate.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he's short. And it's like, hey, that electability, ignore the cosmetic stuff, guys. We've got to change.
Yeah. Elizabeth Edwards is amazing. Louise and I met her when she was in Portland and heard her speak. She is truly.
Well, this is Elizabeth Kucinich.
Oh, Elizabeth Kucinich. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Too, but Elizabeth Kucinich is even more impressive.
Really?
Yeah. Totally impressed. She can handle the issues better than anyone I've seen.
Amazing. Well, Jeff, I have a lot of respect for your insights. Thanks a lot for calling in and keep up the great work. 45 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. We'll be right back.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
This is particularly interesting. A coalition of progressive Democrats who are upset with Dianne Feinstein, in part for her support of Mukasey, in part for her saying that the telco companies, the phone companies who basically spied on us illegally on behalf of Bush, should get immunity, even though apparently what they knew apparently they knew it was illegal. I mean, they have legal departments. In any case, they're going to call for her censure at the California Democratic Party Executive Board meeting this weekend. A group of progressive Democrats going to call for the censure of Dianne Feinstein. This is Max Fulmer blogging over at the Huffington Post. Fascinating. 1-866-303-2270. Let's move along a little faster here. Dave in Phoenix. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, you know, just thinking about comparing Republicans and Democrats, presidential candidates, Reagan back in the, you know, back in the 80s was a really good example of somebody who could deliver a message, you know, with a really positive, optimistic tone that was fairly devoid of substance.
Mm-hmm.
And Democrats...
Well, actually, often it had a lot of substance. I mean, his substance was very destructive to America, but he was clearly anti-union, anti-welfare, anti-social security, you know, pro-corporate, pro-free trade. There was substance in there, David. It just wasn't substance that ultimately was good for this country that you or I would like.
Well, yeah, but the point is that he could make people feel good about it.
That's right.
Deliver a message and make people feel good about the message.
Yeah.
Well, Bill Clinton was the same way.
Yeah, they were both brilliant communicators. I mean, that's the bottom line. But that gets back to the one kind of weakness of the way that this country is organized, and that is that in most countries you have a head of government and a head of state, and they're separate persons. You have a president and a prime minister. You have and the president does the ceremonial stuff and is the head of state and represents the government, and you know, at events and things like that, and the prime minister is the person who's doing the work, and in England you've got a queen and a prime minister, and the queen is the head of state, and the prime minister, you know, Gordon Brown, he's a rumpled guy, he's really brilliant, you know, he's really brilliant, and the British people like, we don't care if he's not a handsome guy, he's brilliant, and then the Queen goes out and cuts the ribbons and shakes hands and does the stuff that's necessary for a head of state. Reagan played the role of head of state very well. Bill Clinton played the role of head of state very well. Jimmy Carter played the role of head of state rather poorly, although he did a brilliant job of being the head of government. We've combined both those functions in one person in the presidency of the United States. And that's, I think, you know, one of the essential problems. People say, you know, well, why is America looking for somebody who, why is charisma such an important thing in a presidential race when really what you're, you know, when really we should be talking about the issues? And it is, I think, because we've combined those two functions. But, Dave, your point is well made. I got to move along. Thank you very much for calling, though. Kirsten in Aberdeen, Washington. Hey, Kirsten.
Yes, Tom. Thank you so much for what you do. I guess what I'd like to say is that for about a year now, I've been getting, I'm one of the feeling modality, by the way.
Uh-huh.
And for quite a while, I've been getting that, there's a possibility there won't be an election in '08. And then the next best thing would be, of course, to have another Republican constituency. But I'd also like to remind people that intention is everything and that we need to hold that light and continue to move our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so important. You had a wonderful Gandhi moment with my dear co-founder Jude in Seattle about 4 months ago at an appearance in Seattle. Mike Malloy was there as well. It was quite a night for her. And she got to meet with you briefly. She was the lady standing with the white flowers.
That's right, when we left.
Yes, and she was so touched by it. And it gave her that fire that she needed to keep going, Tom.
That's great.
And it did me, too. So God bless you for what you do.
Well, and you, I mean, you're out there. This is the Women Standing Group, right? You're out there.
Yes, we are.
Standing for peace and for America. And mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's absolutely marvelous.
Every Sunday I stand at a gun emplacement and hold the flowers. And Jude, of course, goes to the federal buildings, plural, in Seattle and stands there. And what we are seeing happen, Tom, I would like to let everyone know there is a matrix. It is quite spiritual. It is non-denominational. And it is fired up and it is working. And what this great propaganda machine would like to have happen is for us to be discouraged.
Yep.
And I cannot be discouraged. I refuse to participate.
There you go. Amen.
Bless you, Tom.
Thank you, Kirsten. Yeah, we will not be afraid. We need to go back to Franklin Roosevelt. The only thing you have to fear is fear itself. And we're not going to be afraid anymore. Thank you very much. And we are going to get active. Dan in Manhattan. Let's try it again, Dan.
Hey, good, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
You know, the reason that we, the commons, reject the high taxes is even though some of us may not be millionaires, most of us aspire to wealth and work towards it. And we see the inherent unfairness of overtaxation of the wealthy.
Yeah, see, I disagree, Dan. Because if you go back 40, 50 years ago, when the average working person was paying virtually nothing in income taxes, or 60 years ago, when they really were, the average blue-collar worker was paying no income tax or very, 2-3%. It was not an issue for them. What has happened is inflation and Reagan have caused the tax that's hitting working people to become a really substantial part of their, chunk out of their paycheck. Historically, it wasn't. And therefore, working people are saying they're getting sensitive about taxes. And so all the really rich people have to say is if the Democrats say, okay, we're going to raise taxes on people who make over $3 million a year, which is, what Roosevelt's tax was, over $3.2 million a year. They say, well, we're going to raise taxes on people making over $3 million a year. The Republicans will simply repackage that as they're going to raise taxes. And everybody's going to assume that it means everybody. Back in the days when working people paid very little taxes, when they were the, oh my God, they're going to raise taxes. Everybody got, yeah, of course, and you rich guys. And it was a whole different thing. I'm convinced that that's the piece of it. And I think that a Democrat who comes along and says, we're going to substantially reduce the taxes on working people, and we're going to increase the taxes on unearned income and on great wealth, actually will win. It's a strong message that will win. 57 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program as we're moving ahead here toward the campaign, the primary season, and then ultimately the final election, is a new progressive era in the offing. In the last hour, we were talking to Thomas Edsel, who was pointing out that the Republicans have pretty much controlled most of American politics since around the mid-1800s, since Reconstruction, for all practical purposes. There have been a few blips along the road, Franklin Roosevelt being the biggest one, who redefined our nature of government for about 40 years, and then Reagan flipped us back into the era of the Gilded Age, of the robber barons. Simon Rosenberg is with us. He's the president of the New Democratic Network. NewDem.org is their website. And Simon, first of all, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. It's great to be there.
And you're suggesting that it's possible that a new progressive era, really, it says here, the 50-state strategy, a new progressive era, could be on the horizon, that we could be looking at basically the reinvention of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal or of Teddy Roosevelt's vision, which didn't last very long back in that day.
Well, Tom, we have a partner and I, Pete Lydon, have written a piece that's in Mother Jones magazine right now.
Right.
Listeners can check it out at motherjones.org if they want. And we make the case that there are three large transformations going on in America today that are making the politics of the 21st century very different from the 20th. And they are the emergence of a new governing agenda that speaks to today's challenges, the way that media and technology is changing the way that, in a very fundamental way, the way we all communicate. And third is there's a rapidly changing demography in the United States, which is changing the very nature of the people and of this country. And so whichever ideological movement or political party succeeds in the 21st century, frankly, the way that the progressives did in the 20th century, they will have to reform their ideas, their values around these three large changes. And what we argue is that right now, if you use those three measures, offering a new agenda, using the new media, speaking to the new people, progressives seem to be far ahead of their counterparts on the conservative side, and there's great cause for optimism.
Right, this demographic wave, which that America is, there many young people are coming into the mainstream who are accepting as, well, yeah, of course, things that in the 50s and 60s and 70s were like, say what? You know, things like full rights for women and, you know, equality and equal rights for gays and things like that. Issues that Republicans have used as wedge issues, racial issues for that matter. You know, Nixon's Southern strategy.
Yep.
And yet it still seems to me that, and you know, Bob Herbert did a great piece yesterday or the day before in the New York Times about Reagan and Reagan's racial legacy. That racism is very much alive and well in the United States, and as you document the browning of America, as there's a rising up of Hispanics and more African Americans getting involved, and people of other you know, national and cultural and whatnot origins who are not just the generic European WASPs, that along with this is. I'm seeing this incredible rising up of a new racism, a new form of racism that seems to be taking it's new code. The old code used to be states' rights. The new code is stop the immigrants.
Yeah, look, I mean the point we make here is there are lots of demographic changes going on in America, and that the people that the new century are going to be very different from the last. And you know, we become more southern and western and suburban and exurban, Hispanic and Asian, as you point out, more millennial and aging boomer, more digital age in our life and work habits than industrial age. I mean, there are a lot of big changes going on. The two we really drill down on in this piece are the rise of Hispanics and the rise of this, what we call the millennial generation, which are kids today sort of between the ages of 12 and 29, who will be the largest generation in American history. And they will be, for this emerging century, what the boomers were in the 20th century. They're going to leave behind very much a changed politics and culture and media and society, the way that this large generation called the boomers did in the 20th century. And the good news is for progressives that these two groups are leaning very much Democratic right now and are very open to the kind of politics that I think we want to practice in the 21st century. But as you point out, change is hard. I mean, the country is changing. The demographic changes, the rates of immigration are at historical highs. This year we're going to see, for only the third time in American history, more than a million new people become citizens in the United States. So I think it's natural that in any time of great change that there is resistance. I mean, I view this, one could argue there's a pernicious element to this, and certainly I've argued that because I work a lot on the immigration issue. But I also think, to be more sympathetic, that, you know, our country is changing a great deal, right? I mean, we're using, for example, a stat I use, when I graduated from college, 90% of anybody watching a television at any time was watching one of the live broadcast television networks. In 2008, it's going to be about a third, right? So even the common box that we
but you still have you still have, you know, fewer than a dozen companies who own all of the content on all of those other channels.
Yep. Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, we're not getting into all that today because I'm not going to dispute your arguments about. I'm familiar with your take on this. I think the key thing though is that what we're seeing is, and we talk about this in the article, is that all these bottom-up media tools, the changing demography, the new issues that are on the horizon, really lend themselves, I think, to, we believe, optimism about a new progressive era, the way that FDR ushered in the 1930s. And let's just take the bottom-up media stuff that you're referring to, is that, you know, what we're seeing today through the use of the Internet is that, you know, Democrats now, particularly Democrats, Republicans have really not adopted these tools, are involving many more millions of people in their politics, making their politics, frankly, much more based on the passion and the will and the money of the middle class rather than people of privilege. We're seeing many more people vote. We're seeing greater rates of participation in sort of every way you measure participation in American life. And I believe deeply, and I think we argue in this piece, that the Internet has had a very much a democratizing effect. It's allowing average people to get in the game in a very meaningful way, blunting some of the power and privilege in our politics, right? This is a good thing. And it's important to recognize that Democrats, the party that's supposed to be the party of the people, are the ones adopting these new tools, these bottom-up tools, allowing average citizens to play in a much more meaningful way. The Republicans are way behind. And in part because this kind of bottom-up media and bottom-up participation is, frankly, inimical to their politics, which is very top-down, command and control, right, as you've pointed out many times on your show. And it's interesting that we're seeing for the first time, I would argue, let me just go through this very quickly. Democrats right now, even though we may be disappointed with how much progress was made in Congress this year, we're clearly putting ideas like climate change and how to deal with broad-based prosperity in a more global age, some of the big issues we're putting on the table. Second thing is we're using this new 21st century media much more effectively than the other side is. And third, if you look at the candidates running for president, our field looks like 21st century America. Their field looks like 1950s America. And it's why I'm very optimistic about what will happen with strong leadership, great citizen participation, and the work of folks like you, you know, who to really chart out a better and more optimistic future for the country.
I am too. I am the eternal optimist, and it's amazing how much flack I get for it, but I really believe that the meme, the vision, the core idea at the founding of this country, even though it was imperfectly acted out. I mean, we still had slavery and women couldn't vote and all those other things. But nonetheless, that core ideal of small d democracy, of grassroots, of ground up governance, of we the people, is burned into the DNA of Americans. And it's going to take a lot more than George Bush and the Republican Party to throw it out. On the other hand, you've got enormous wealth and entrenched family wealth, multi-generational family wealth, and corporate wealth that has seized so much power over so many decades, arguably over well over a century, and consolidated it within the Republican Party. How do the Democrats take these things that you've identified, Simon Rosenberg, in your piece that is over at motherjones.org, or you can read about it at newdem.com, or at newdem.org, excuse me. How do Democrats take this and run with it? I'm sorry, we have about a half a minute.
Well, and I'll be happy to come back another time, Tom, and talk some more. But I think, the first step is that most of the freshman Democrats in the House, their largest source of money was average $25, you know, average people giving $25 through groups like Move On and Act Blue and the blogs and the Netroots. That's a big deal. That means that they are coming to Congress more beholden to everyday people than to private special interests. That's a big change. It's not the way it was 10 years ago. So I think this citizen involvement, the bottom-up stuff that's going on the Internet, this is the beginning of a whole new era of politics. We should be excited and optimistic. I hope your listeners get a chance to check out the article. We'd love feedback on our site if you can. Tom, invite me back. Be happy to come on another day.
Great. Okay. Simon Rosenberg, newdem.org is the website, motherjones.org if you want to read his article, The 50-Year Strategy, A New Progressive Era. Simon, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. What direction is the country going? We really are standing at one of those major turning points. You talk about living in interesting times. This is it, right now. 866-303-2270. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
So which way is America going? Are we becoming more progressive? Are the Republicans in a... I mean, we've heard now, in the last 2 hours, from two people who have really studied this at length and in depth, and one of them suggesting, no, the Republican Party never went away. It is the power of wealth, and it is the party of wealth and power, and it fully intends to stay that way. And it's got a few Democratic allies along the way and entrenched special interests. I mean, yeah, I suppose you could track this back, if my book Unequal Protection, track this back to the 1886 Santa Clara County versus the Southern Pacific Railroad, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad case before the Supreme Court, when the Supreme Court did not rule, but the clerk wrote into the headnotes that they had ruled incorrectly, but nonetheless, that's how it got written, that corporations are persons, and that they should have certain rights under the Constitution, just like you and me, even though they can live forever, and they can aggregate unlimited wealth, and they can clone themselves, and they can't marry, and they don't eat, and they don't care if the water is clean, and the air can be breathed, and all that kind of thing. So anyhow, that kind of power aggregated in the Republican Party, on the one hand. On the other hand, an awakening America. An America that this generation, the millennial generation, the Gen X generation, the generations that have come up since the boomers are more wired in, they're more tuned in, they're paying attention to what's going on, particularly with regard to politics on the Internet, participating in blogs and reading websites, commondreams.org, Huffington Post, opednews.com, buzzflash.com. I mean, there's rawstory.com, truthout.org. There's a bunch of really good, I mean, deep content. Thinkprogress.org. There's a whole bunch of sites out there that are providing really good and useful talking points, memo. Josh Marshall said, a lot of good stuff out there. And on the Reich, most of the stuff that you see is just purely partisan. It's purely polemic. It's our side versus their side. You know, they're bad, we're good, you know, that kind of thing. And not really digging into the issues and not talking about the issues, not talking about them with substance. And so, you know, which is going to prevail? I'm telling you, the only thing that will prevail against the entrenched power of massive inherited wealth and massive corporate transnational power, because Teddy Roosevelt tried to take them on in the early part of the 20th century, the early 1900s. Franklin Roosevelt took them on in the 1930s after the Republican Great Depression. And frankly, Dwight Eisenhower continued that to some extent, to a large extent. And Jack Kennedy. The only thing that will take them on is an energized populace, is people who remember, you know, because those were the generations that remembered the panics, the financial panics of the 1890s that were arguably as bad as the Great Depression of the 1930s, and who remembered the Republican Great Depression of 1929, you know, through World War II. They remembered that. And now we've got a couple of generations that really don't have any recollection of anything other than there always being something that resembled a middle class, and they're watching that be disassembled right in front of them. And they're starting to realize that the people doing the disassembly of the middle class, some of them calling themselves Democrats, most of them calling themselves Republicans, by and large across the board calling themselves conservatives, that those people who are dismantling the middle class are not working in their interests. And no matter how much they may yell about social issues or look out, the gays are coming or whatever, that it's, you know, no matter how much they can appeal to their bigotry, their economic interests are going to trump their bigotry even. So it's interesting times. It's interesting times. And I think actually I'm very optimistic. I am sharing our Simon Rosenberg's optimism on this and have been all along. But let us never underestimate the power behind the Republican Party and the power that frankly seeks to corrupt and has largely corrupted to some extent and in some ways to a significant extent the Democratic Party, and that we need to take it back from. Lynn in Los Angeles, we have a minute before we got to take a break. You some thoughts for today? Lynn?
Sorry, I didn't know if you were talking to me.
Yep, you're on the air.
I was wondering, actually, if you could answer a question of mine. I was thinking of changing my party status for voting over to Republican or just open ballot where I have either choice. And, of course, for primary, it has to be Republican, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And voting for somebody that we either think that we can beat or somebody that we wouldn't mind so much, like Ron Paul or something like that. Would that be a good idea?
No, I don't think so. I think it's that you're, Lynn, you're wandering into the area of the ends justifies the means, you know, and I think it's far more important to participate in the Democratic primary and get somebody in who actually represents Democratic values, small D Democratic values in the big D Democratic Party, than try to blow up the Republican Party. They'll blow themselves up, you know. But I can tell you that, you know, what you're talking about is something that a lot of people are talking about, a lot of people are thinking about, and certainly in states that have open primaries, Republicans have done this for, well, Democrats have done it, both parties have done it for years and years, you know, sabotage the other party. But I'd encourage you instead to stay with the Democratic Party and vote with it. But thanks for the call. Appreciate it. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the co-winner of this year's Nobel Peace Prize, participating in a UN meeting in Valencia, Spain right now. And Yvo de Boers, comments. He's the top climate official at the United Nations, the number one guy at the United Nations in charge of climate issues. He just came out and said that if we continue to ignore how important and urgent this issue is, I'm not quoting, I'm paraphrasing. Here's the quote. He said, we will be, quote, criminally irresponsible. We the world. Criminally irresponsible if we continue to ignore global warming. Amazing. Amazing. And meantime, Warren Buffett out there saying, yes, please, tax my estate. It's an important tax. Keep it. This, I think the second, third, fourth richest guy in America. Pretty amazing. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Tim in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ.
Hey, Tom.
Tim.
The passion of the protests and the environmental concerns and equal rights and everything that was so prevalent in the 60s and 70s, the statistics showed that a lot of those people tended to vote Republican in the 80s, and I think it was due more to like a kind of a self-interest temporarily for a while. And I believe that passion and activism and concern for the environment and others will come back to the boomers as they develop and different things become more important in their lives.
Yeah, well, it definitely is. It amazes me when I go to anti-war rallies and speak at events like that or book signings, whatever
important.
It may be. Yeah, you know, what in some cases is 60, 70, 80% boomer generation. That's both the good news and the bad news. I mean, you know, it's the good news in that, yes, you're right, the boomers are coming back to progressive politics, the progressive politics of the 60s. The bad news is, where are all the 20-somethings?
Good question. I'm stymied.
Yeah, me too, and it concerns me. Although, as you know, Simon Rosenberg was saying, you know, they're there, they're with us. They just maybe have a different way of speaking out. They're speaking out on Facebook or on, you know, on their blogs and
maybe the current situation is affecting how they might view things in the future, like the disaster of the current Republican regime.
Yeah,
will have an effect.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Good point. Chet in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Chet, you want to disagree with me? Why?
Well, it's really a minor point. First off, I'd like to say that you educate me every day when I listen to you, and I really appreciate what you do.
Thank you.
Secondly, going along with your last guest, there's another ray of progressive hope. The station that broadcasts you in the Chicago area, WCPT, 850 AM, Chicago's Progressive Talk, on Monday, November 26th, is moving to a newer and stronger frequency, a little farther left on the dial at AM 820. So,
right. And they're going to just, I think it's just about quadruple the area that they're reaching,
right,
with this new signal. It's great news for our Chicago affiliate, and congratulations to the folks at WCPT.
And even though it's essentially a daytime broadcast station, it does have longer hours than the current frequency. So
yeah,
all to the good. You've often used the phrase that the middle class and working people in the economy started dropping down the rabbit hole under Ronald Reagan. And I don't essentially disagree, but as a former Teamster and a former trucker, I went through the searing experience of losing my job because of deregulation. And that was,
Carter,
unfortunately, a process that began under a Democratic president, Jimmy Carter,
yeah,
also airline deregulation. And one of the principal movers and shakers behind the passage of deregulation, unfortunately, was a man who I otherwise greatly admire, namely Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts.
Yep.
I've often hoped that I would run into him someday and say, why did you do that, Senator?
I'm very familiar with that because in the 1980s, Louise and I started a business in the travel industry. We started a company in Atlanta called International Wholesale Travel, and with a local retail agency as well, Sprayberry Travel, that was going after specifically the small business market because we felt it was a very unserved market. We built that business up over a three-year period to be about a $6 million business, sold it, and that's when we moved to Europe. And that company, I think last year, did $24 million in sales. That company's done like $250 million in revenue since we started it. And the what we were doing in starting that company was taking advantage of the deregulation of the travel industry. And you're right, it did start under Carter. And what it illustrates is that even Jimmy Carter was drinking the Kool-Aid. And it wasn't just Carter. I mean, it was the Congress. I mean, it was right across the board. Certainly, this wasn't anything that was done solely by Jimmy Carter. But you're right, the whole deregulation fervor started in the late 70s. And also, when you look at when the salaries of you know, the wages, when you look at wage income, set aside dividend and interest income, when wage income started dropping or flattening out and then ultimately dropping in real terms, it was really around 78. And, you know, and you look at the graphs. So, you know, you're spot on, Chet, and you know, thanks for reminding us all of it and making the point. I mean, just because somebody's a Democrat doesn't mean that they've got, you know, as I said, Bill Clinton signed GATT and NAFTA, pushed that thing through. I hope that today he wouldn't do the same. I really hope that today he wouldn't do the same. But, you know, at a certain point you have to say, okay, live and learn. Mike in Georgia. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. What's up?
Oh, I just want to say I'm a long time listener, first time caller. It's a great honor to speak with you. When you were talking to Mr. Edsel, you described a friend of mine to a T, barely scraping by, you know, but he calls me on a daily basis. Oh, isn't the economy doing great? But he's not making any money.
Yeah.
And, you know, I asked him, I said, why do you work a Republican? Well, because they're anti-abortion. They had the president, they had the executive branch, they had the Senate, they had the Congress, and they had the judicial. And they never even put a bill forward to end abortion.
Right. Or to criminalize it, actually. Because if you want to end abortions, during those times when birth control and sex education was most widely available, those were the times when the number of abortions declined most significantly. And the states where people don't have access to birth control and don't have access to good sex education schools, those are the states where you find the highest abortion rates. So if you want to end abortions, that's how you do it. Or if you want to diminish them radically, you're never going to end them. Even if you criminalize them, you're never going to end them.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. They just played these people like suckers, the people who think that abortion should be criminalized.
Exactly. I mean, and he's got a daughter that lives in the Northeast. I do too. And, you know, last week when oil almost hit $100 a barrel, she called him and said, I don't know how I'm going to heat my house this winter.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to cost me a phenomenal amount. And he called me and he said, I see what you're saying. I said, you know, it's not that there. I mean, Bob Dole was a great American. I mean, he still is. I shouldn't say great like he's dead. But, you know, I mean, there were Republicans that I could agree with. But the neocons, I just cannot see how anybody that makes anywhere from $10,000 to $100,000 a year can be in the conservative party with these people.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's you know? the whole wedge issue, the whole Southern strategy thing. And spot on. Well said, Mike. Thank you very much. Dave in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. Hey, a little insight to your question about President Clinton. Mm-hmm. He was on our television broadcast. He was locally over in Ontario, Canada. And they highlighted a speech that he did. And his comment was, the U.S. dollar and wages are suppressed and a lot of people want to blame free trade. Well, it, as far as free trade goes, it's just a big smokescreen to the real issues. And I'm kind of like, what?
So he's still drinking the Tom Friedman Kool-Aid.
Yesterday he said that.
Oh, man. I'm so sorry.
And how much
that,
influence
Dave.
Will he have in the near future?
Yeah. Well, see, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist here, but the fact of the matter is that Bill Clinton is now part of the old boy network. You know,
yes,
he's now part of the establishment.
Bush and, Sr. put his arm around him and said, welcome to the club.
Yeah,
Can I say one thing about David Walker?
Sure.
A year and a
the
half.
The comptroller of the currency you're talking about.
David Walker, the GAO, the head guy?
Yeah, the head of the – is he the head of the Governmental Accountability Office? I thought he was the comptroller of the currency.
No, unless...
Okay, I'm mixing my names up. In any case, go ahead.
A year and a half ago, he on C-SPAN, I watched it live, Tom, and he gave a summation of the Bush presidency, and he said, as a whole package, when you look at the whole package, the presidency from the whatever he has done, it's going to cost us $50 trillion in debt. And he had a way or ways that we should be moving forward. And, Tom, in a year and a half, I heard recently what the on the Democratic agenda, Tom, we're not even close.
Yeah.
And he said the Titanic is full steam ahead.
Yeah, it's the old joke about the professional gambler who, and Dave, you know, well said. David Walker, in fact, has been on this program. It's the old joke about the professional gambler who decided to take a cruise for a vacation, but just, you know, hey, there was a card game going on down in the boiler room, so he goes down and shows up and says, deal me in, guys. And they're dealing the cards, and he's pulling a 10 and a jack and a queen and a king and an ace, and they're all the same suit, and he's going, holy, I've never gotten a royal flush in my life. I mean, the luck must just be incredible on this cruise ship, the Titanic. I mean, you know, that's kind of like what it's about. It's like everybody's out there gambling. Everybody's talking about, oh, gee, it's time to look at the stock market. You know, the stock market's doing really well, so the economy must be getting stronger and stronger. Isn't that a wonderful thing? And no, it's not. I'm sorry. It's the stock market will do well because corporations are laying more people off. He will say productivity is up. Productivity is up because more jobs are being outsourced to India, so a corporation can do more with fewer humans. If it's doing more with fewer people in this country, it looks like the productivity of the people in this country has gone up. It hasn't. The productivity of per person statistically has gone up, but that's because so many other people in India and China and other places are doing that work now. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Bitch for last picks became suspect and bending low as if to hear. Well, in the armies who ceased advancing because the people held their ear. Oh, and the shepherds soldiers, will they laid beneath the stars, exchanging visions and laying arms, or to waste in the dust, in the form of shining valleys, oh, where the pure air recognized, and my senses newly opened, cause I awakened into the cry.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hours. Yeah, people have the power. Ellen Radner with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com on the line. Hey, Ellen, are you watching this thing going on with the State Department's Inspector General?
Well, you mean the morning? I have not watched in the last hour. I certainly saw the beginning where Waxman's opening statement was just an absolute killer.
Well, this is what we're talking about here for our listeners who don't know. Howard Krongard is the guy who is in the State Department, is supposed to be looking into corruption in the State Department. He's like the chief cop inside the State Department, the Inspector General. He, back some in September, September 18th, Waxman revealed that he had told his investigators to, quote, immediately stop cooperating, end quote, with federal investigators who were looking into whether or not weapons that were illegally smuggled into Iraq by Blackwater employees were then being sold on the black market. He ordered the State Department to stop looking into that, okay? Turns out his brother's on the board of Blackwater. What's his name? Waxman, the mustache for justice, as Christy Harvey calls him. Asked him about this morning, and he said, I don't think my brother's on the board of Blackwater. And during the break, he calls his brother, and just a few minutes ago, he came out and he said, I just talked to my brother. Yes, he's on the board of Blackwater. I hereby recuse myself from any Blackwater stuff. Isn't that amazing?
It is completely amazing. What he did this morning, this is Waxman, is he talked about the fact that he tried to prevent any, Krongard tried to prevent any looking into labor trafficking by the country of Kuwait, and told his own staffers to have a cease and desist order in terms of looking into anything with Kuwait, that they did not look at the construction overruns in the embassy that is being built in Baghdad, and so far it's 144 a million more than they ever projected. And then apparently he was extremely abusive to the staff, didn't look into the investigation of Kenneth Tomlinson, who, as you know, ran the Broadcasting Board of Governors. And this morning Waxman said that his office is bleeding people right and left.
Wow. Now, this is just a hearing on his performance, right?
That's right.
There's no action contemplated out of this.
No action at this point. This is just a complete performance oversight, as they say.
Amazing. And, well, I guess we're getting some oversight into this guy's performance, and it's pretty ugly.
Yeah, to say the least. On another issue, it looks as if, and we hear this directly from the ACLU, who is watching this issue, and that has to do with the immunity wiretapping. It looks as if, and apparently according to the ACLU, that they're floating around the possibility that they may make the government responsible for the wiretapping, therefore essentially saying that AT&T, et cetera, were not responsible, but it was the government that was. First of all, very difficult to sue the government.
Well, you had to get the permission of the government to sue the government.
Exactly. And even if you can, they can then say, well, we needed this for national security and that for national security. So now this may be, with the Democrats' permission, this may be happening that way.
And this is the thing that Dianne Feinstein has been promoting. One of the reasons why this weekend at the Democratic Party in California, there's going to be apparently a motion put forward to censure her in California, because she's been promoting, in part because of Mukasey, but also in part because she's been on the, you know, let's give them a pass side.
It's unclear why she is coming from that direction. Interestingly enough, there's also a lot of rumors around town that the Democrats, really through Rahm Emanuel and now through Van Hollen, are choosing Democrats not only that can win, but perhaps even people who may be former Republicans or blue dogs, because maybe of some of the issues around trade and other issues that are very friendly to either the Clinton administration or to blue dog Democrats,
right,
that they can get a majority with.
Yeah, this is there's a battle within the Democratic Party between the progressive wing, the Howard Dean wing, frankly, and the conservative wing, the Republican light wing, which is the Rahm Emanuel and Steny Hoyer bunch and the DLC, frankly.
Now, I know we don't necessarily deal with an older demographic, but you and I are heading in that direction. It looks like the Medicare bill was going to cut down and cut 10% of physicians' fees this year.
Whoa.
Well, okay, they're now thinking of not doing that and putting a moratorium on it between 1 or 2 years. But one of the ways they're thinking of offsetting it is that in a couple more years, they're going to cut down physicians' fees even more, or perhaps change home health care issues for Medicare and or oxygen.
Wow.
It seems unbelievable.
Well, this is why we need Medicare for all, because right now Medicare recipients are a relatively small constituency and don't have the kind of political power that we all would if everybody in the United States could buy into or got, actually, as Michael Moore says, for free, like they do in France, got Medicare. I mean, you know, it's just let's just have a national single-payer health care system. And then you can bet that your politicians are going to be attending to whether or not the services are working.
Yes, and of course there are people like Edwards that are saying, if I was president, I'm going to make health care work, or I'm going to put everybody on my staff on the same health care that we're asking other Americans to be on,
right,
which is not health care.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, John Edwards is very good on this issue. Dennis Kucinich is very good on this issue. Interesting. Okay, great. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Thanks for the update, Ellen.
Thank you.
Always great to hear from you. Let's see here. I lost my paperweight. What's coming up next? Well, I'm broadcasting live today here from New York, WWRL, our mother station, Air America, the mother ship. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. You're tuned into the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Well, this is interesting. Welcome back to the third hour of our program. The House Senate Conference on the Transportation HUD spending bill. Now, this sounds kind of wonky, but, you know, the way a bill happens, a piece of legislation is introduced in the House that says, baby carriages have to meet a certain safety standard. And so then a similar piece of legislation is introduced in the Senate that says essentially the same thing, but it was written by some senator instead of a congressman. And it's typically the language is slightly different, or sometimes there's different provisions or whatnot. they both get passed, and they go to what's called a conference. And that conference of members of the House and Senate, they basically, you know, rewrite the bill. And then, you know, it goes back for a vote, and boom, off it goes. And to the president. And stuff gets slipped in at conference that nobody ever knew was there. And the thing that just got slipped into this transportation HUD spending bill is a provision, and I'm reading this over at Think Progress. No, this is the Center for American Progress outing this thing. They're not identifying who slipped it in. I'm not sure that we know yet. That would ban the public from having timely access to budget information for the Transportation Department. Interesting. Very interesting. So, you know, sometimes you look around and go, we live in truly strange times, I'm telling you. By the way, Eliot Spitzer, the governor of New York, has dropped his attempt to offer driver's licenses to illegal immigrants. And he's given up on it. And I'm here in New York right now. I was watching the news last night at my friend Jerry Schneiderman's house. And just it was amazing to the commentators were talking about how if he was to run for governor right now, he's got like something like 24% support. I mean, it's absolutely in the tank, and mostly because of this issue. And it's not that America is anti-immigrant. I think that, you know, if you were to poll most Americans, you know, should we have a proactive immigration policy? I mean, there are people around the world who desperately need to go someplace. You know, I mean, we've created the world's second largest refugee crisis in Iraq and the countries around it. And we have always been a country that welcomed immigrants. But on the one hand, there's like an A and a B to this. The A, people are concerned that economic immigrants, people who are coming here simply because they're looking for a better job than they can get in their own country, which is largely people coming from south of the border, are competing for jobs, and, you know, I don't think it's the biggest variable that is hurting our economy. I'd say the two biggest variables that are hurting our economy are, number one, so-called free trade, and number two, the war on organized labor. But it's probably number three. I mean, it's there, and people realize it. People get it, and they're starting to get upset about it. So you've got that issue, you know, going on there, and at the same time, I think Americans would say and do say, you know, we welcome immigrants into the United States, and you know, but then you've got this rowdy band of basically racists who are running around going, oh my God, you know, it's the invasion of the brown people, and you know, America's not going to be a white country, and all this, you know, come on. Take a breath, get a grip. So there are real economic issues here. But the B part of this is that across the board, as the American middle class is being chopped away at the knees by 26 years of conservative economic policies, by Reaganomics, and as one of our callers in the last hour, I mean, even starting, you know, with deregulation under Carter, 30 years, let's say, of conservative economic policies, of what's referred to in Europe as neoliberalism. As this is decimating the middle class in America, people are looking for scapegoats. And people who look different and speak a different language and came from a different country, they make convenient scapegoats. So Eliot Spitzer, although, you know, frankly, I think that his proposal, it was nuanced. And when you get into the nuance of it, you know, with his multi-tiered types of driver's licenses and all that kind of thing, you know, broadly speaking, I was opposed to it, but I understand what he's trying to do, and I'm not sure I would have voted against it, and I certainly wouldn't use this as an issue to vote for or against him. But it got so turned into a black and white issue, so it's an all or nothing, so it's a he's giving the store away stuff that that he's just had to back away, and in fact he's running away from it, and in a way it tells us something about the level of political discourse in the United States, something that's unpleasant, in my opinion. On the other hand, it also tells us probably the larger message here, and hopefully the one that Governor Spitzer is getting, because I think he's a decent governor in New York, is getting, is that Americans are terrified about the economy. And if they think that illegal immigrants are hurting their economic prospects, their chance of having a decent job with a pension and health care and job security, then, you know, don't go there. If they think that free trade is hurting that, and as I said, I think that that's the so-called free trade. It's corporate trade, corporatist, multinational corporatist trade. You're going to do it. Then you know, let's get with the program here, Democrats. And Governor Spitzer, respectfully, and start talking about the progressive issues. Start talking about the grassroots economic issues. Let's start working for the right of people to unionize. Let's work for things like card check. Let's work for, frankly, for tariff policies that will protect American workers like we did for 200 years in the United States. Fred in Los Angeles, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Fred, thanks for calling the program. What's up?
Yeah, I taught economics for 30 years, and incidentally, I'm also a folk singer. I sent your wife a couple songs, but I'm calling about Adam Smith here. You know, you're the first guy I ever heard mention how desperately ignorant Ronald Reagan was in talking about the free market, a kind of an evil genius that changed the discourse of how we think about the role of government. And actually, you know, Adam Smith never used the term, quote, free market. And there's a whole bunch of stuff. I'll just give you one.
And, in fact, invisible hand, the phrase invisible hand, only appears once in Wealth of Nations, and it's in a cautionary context.
That's right. But there's a bunch of stuff. I can't find all my lecture notes here, but here's one of the best quotes. Smith is talking about the businessman. This is an exact quote. He says, "There's hardly an occasion for merriment or diversion that the conversation turns to some contrivance to raise price or a conspiracy against the public." In other words, the businessman can't even go to a cocktail party that they're trying to figure out some way to cheat the public.
Right.
And I've given that quote, it's never in the textbook, to my economist over the years, and I say, "Who said that?" And they'll say, "Oh, that's Marx."
Right. No, it's Adam Smith. You're right. Yeah, Wealth of Nations is a very difficult book to read. It's very dense. I mean, it's written in the language of 1776. But it's worth slogging through. It took me the better part of a year and a half, actually, to, you know, setting it beside the bed and read a page a night, you know, sometimes. But there is there's some stuff in there that I don't think is so relevant now. But good point, Fred, and you know, thank you very much for making it. I appreciate it.
You ought to mention, too, that he came up with the ability principle of taxation, and that implies, obviously, progressive income tax.
Yeah. Yeah, and also a differentiator between wages and earnings, or wages and passive income.
That's right, and set the stage, you know, probably for Marxism. But you can see now why, you know, I've done music for 40 years. I've done 30 concerts with Pete Seeger, and that's why in the last 20 years I've been doing a lot of music, and that's why I sent these songs to Louise. And I've been on your rival Nova M for 40 minutes and a handful of other stations.
Yeah.
I do these small college concerts. But I think you ought to hammer away at that. I mean, there has to be some foundation in our public discussions. The level of discourse is so low. And, you know, it wouldn't hurt once in a while to remind people, you know, that there is a history of the role of government.
Well, part of the problem, Fred, is during the 1980s, you had the campaign that started in our public schools that David Horowitz is now continuing in our colleges.
Right.
To purge our schools of civics classes because they were being taught by socialist union member teachers. Remember that during the Reagan administration? And all of the textbooks got consolidated in the hands of two or three publishers in Texas. They all had to be vetted by the Texas School Board. And we no longer teach economics, and we no longer teach, frankly, American history. We just say, memorize these dates.
So we
really need to bring back critical thinking. We need and we really need to bring back to it into our school system, into our public school system, the real history of the United States and the economic and the political history and the ideals, the concepts on which this country was founded. Fred, thanks so much for the call and for the great music that you're making. By the way, for our listeners in San Diego, I know we've got a lot of people who are listening on the web in San Diego right now. Louise says she's being overwhelmed by emails. We have a link at the top of TomHartman.com to a blog that was put up for our San Diego listeners. Go check it out. Go to TomHartman.com and click the link at the very top.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Let me tell you.
So what's going on with the Veterans Administration? Let's check in with Larry Scott, Chief Cook and Bottle Washer over at VAWatchdog.org, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. And Larry Scott, you're doing a marvelous job of it. Welcome to the program.
Well, I appointed myself, and the appointment is stuck.
There you go. I love this this new slogan that you've put up at the top of your website. It is illogical to put a cap on VA funding when it's impossible to put a cap on the number of those wounded and injured in service to their country.
Now, you stop and think about that. Every year, the president or Congress puts a cap on VA funding, and they say, okay, no, we're only going to spend so much money there. But they don't put a cap on the number of people who are injured or who are wounded while they're in service to the country. How can you put a cap on one when, obviously, there's no cap on the other? It doesn't make sense, but it's the way the system works.
Right. There's quotation marks around this. Is this a quote from the famous Larry Scott or from somebody else?
Yours truly, yes.
Well done. Well done. Top story on VAWatchdog.org, the CBS, this new stunning discovery that they made.
CBS News has been working on this story for about 5 months, and they started the series last night, and we're posting all the videos on VAWatchdog.org so people can pick them up on a day-to-day basis. What they found, that they wanted to look at veteran suicides. They had had a nibble from a Department of Defense report, and a few weeks ago the VA started their nationwide 24/7 suicide hotline that's based out of Canandaigua, New York, staffed with workers 24/7. And so CBS said, well, exactly how many veterans or what kind of problem is suicide in the veteran community? Nobody has those figures. The Department of Defense would only talk about people on active duty. VA doesn't keep the figures, and I'll show you how bad they are. Even Senator Patty Murray of Washington, who sits on the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, went to the VA, and they wouldn't give her any figures. She said, oh, we don't keep those figures.
That's incredible, and she's one of the best advocates for veterans out there.
Absolutely. What CBS had to do is they had to go out to all the states. 45 states responded with suicide numbers, and they have found that in the last 12 years, on average, the suicide rate among veterans is twice that of the civilian population.
Wow.
Just plainly and simply.
Now, is there a clear incline in that seems to be associated with the Iraq War, or does this go back to the Gulf War, or could it simply be that suicide rates among veterans have always been higher?
Suicide rates, it appears, in all the years are higher. One year they pointed out was in 2005, where over 6,200 veterans nationwide committed suicide. You know, again, that number is more than twice the civilian population, but they found in the younger vets, and here's where we get a direct tie to the current wars, Tom, that in the 20 to 24 age group, which are obviously the young veterans coming home, that figure jumps up to about 3 to 4 times, depending on how you analyze those figures.
Wow.
So, yes, the stresses of the current wars are taking a toll in the veterans community. What is an interesting aside here is that the investigative team that did this just came out and said, flat out, the VA doesn't want to look at this, because if the VA takes a look at it, they're going to have to deal with it, and the VA doesn't want to deal with it.
Because there's a cap on their budget.
Yes, it is absolutely true. Part two of this series will be on CBS News tonight. This is when they go after the VA and the VA suicide prevention programs, and basically the VA having ignored this issue for so long.
This is the newscast with Katie Couric, CBS
Evening
News.
Evening News. And
worth checking
it depends on what market you're in as to exactly the time it's aired.
Right,
it is the evening newscast. And again, as soon as we get the video clips, we'll have it posted and embedded at VAWatchdog.org.
Great. We're talking with Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, his website, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. Larry, you point out on your website the Democrats failed to get a VA funding bill in before Veterans Day, and the Republicans are beating them up about it. I have a feeling that the Republicans beating the Democrats up about it is at some level a little disingenuous.
Well, it's a little disingenuous, Don, but it's how the game is played. Basically, for the last, the VA's had a budget on time once in the last 13 years. And if we go back over 13 years, who controlled Congress?
Right.
Out of 12 of those 13 years, it would have been Republicans. So it's the same game. What's happened is the Republicans didn't get budgets passed in the past. The Democrats took shots at them. Now it's the other way around. We're seeing problems with the Democrats not putting the bill forward. I wish they would just strip out the VA funding, send it to the president, and say, sign it or veto it, instead of playing games. But they're doing bill stacking right now. We'll see what happens in the next week or two.
Yeah. Any other news on the VA that you think we should know about here?
Yeah,
in the 30 seconds or so we have left.
A very interesting follow-up study came out yesterday on Iraq vets. They found that they did an initial mental health screening of Iraq vets and then did a second one 6 months later. They found that mental health problems, which include symptoms of PTSD, severe depression, and alcohol abuse, went up nearly 3 times. These are self-reported problems.
Wow.
Okay, from the initial screening when they came home to a second screening 6 months later.
War as hell.
It is, and we see the problems increasing, and let's just hope the VA gets their funding so they can take care of these troops. Huh?
Yeah. You can't drop people into hell. I mean, it really is hell. You can't drop them into hell and then expect when they come back to that everything's going to be just fine. You know,
that's true.
It's amazing. VAWatchdog.org, the website. Larry Scott. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Tom.
Keep up the great work.
Thanks.
866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com, our blog, and also our website. There's a link off to our San Diego blog there as well, and AirAmerica.com.
The Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Every morning just to keep a job, I gotta fight my way through the bustling mob. Sound of the city pounding in my brain while another day goes down the drain.
Yeah, the world is fine. It was especially fine back in the days when at 5 o'clock you could knock off. It's like, I don't know anybody who's only working a 40-hour week anymore. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann with you. 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number, TomHartmann.com. Our website, AirAmerica.com. Our blog. And for our San Diego listeners, there's a link up at the top of TomHartmann.com that goes to a blog that Cliff Albert, the program director of KLSD, put up for people to talk about media in San Diego and progressive media in San Diego, and you know, some talking, some complaining, some idea hatching, some conspiracy making, some cool stuff going on over there. Mark in New Hampshire, thanks for calling, Mark. You're on the air. What's up?
Oh, Tom, thank you so much for taking my call. I got to say, I have as little faith in the Democratic Party as I do in the Republican, given how much big money influences what goes on in our country. It's like, you know, what do you do?
Well, there's two things you can do. One is you can go to the website of one of the Democrats that you think is not influenced by big money. And you know, without naming names, I suspect, you know,
Kucinich.
Yeah. Basically Kucinich, in my opinion, Kucinich and Edwards, but you know, it's and give them $25 or $50. I mean, just, you know, I have done that with both of them and more than once. And that's the first thing. The second thing you could do is you can call their campaigns and say, how can I help out? Or, you know, can I volunteer or whatever? Third thing that you can do is show up at your local Democratic Party meetings and say, I'm here. I, you know, let me volunteer. I'll do what I can. Run for office in your local, you know, as a for, you know, to be a member of the or a participant in the local Democratic Party. And also, frankly, I would say get involved with the local Green Party, because the Green Party is one of the major forces for change in the United States, in as much as, particularly at the local level, in as much as they're responsible for over 300 communities in the United States now having instant runoff voting, which both the Democrats and the Republicans oppose because it would break the lock of the two-party system. So, you know, there's a lot that can be done, but a lot of it, an awful lot of it, Mark, I think has to do with, you know, looking at good candidates but getting out there and getting involved. And it's so amazing to me how much money, you know, we had John Edwards on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he said, as I recall, 94% of all of the funds that he has raised, which is millions and millions. I mean, you know, he's one of the top three. Well over 90% of all the funds he's raised has come in small contributions through people on the internet, and it's continuing to. And I know that that's the case with Dennis Kucinich as well. So, you know, there's some good ones there. Mark, in fact, thanks a lot for the call. We've got a clip. It's over at Democratic Underground, and it's apparently from a talk that John Edwards was giving yesterday or the day before in Iowa. And it's a particularly poignant and important point that he makes. And so, Chris, play that.
When I talk about it's not enough to just elect a Democrat, I'm dead serious about that. In the 1990s, When the health care reform effort was made to bring universal health care, we had a Democratic president, we had a Democratic Senate, and we had a Democratic House. And the drug companies, insurance companies, their lobbyists killed it. They killed it. The only way this is going to happen is if we bring real and fundamental change to the way this government operates, and we're willing to take these people on. This is a battle. It is a fight. And for people to say, well, you know, that's not hopeful enough. We need to be more hopeful. Listen, I am hopeful. I am hopeful. But I'm also a fighter. And I'll give you an example. You know, before I ever got into politics, I spent 20 years fighting these people in courtrooms. Really, 20 years. If you just picture in your mind, I'd walk into courtrooms, me and a child or whoever I represented, a family, and on the other side would be all the corporate lawyers and all their money. And I didn't just walk into that courtroom over and over. I walked in there and beat them over and over.
Yeah, he's going to tell a story in just a second of one particular case. But this is when was the last time we had a president who actually talked about taking on big corporate interests? I'll tell you, the last time we had a president who talked about that, Jimmy Carter to some extent did it, breaking up AT&T, but even that was a small gesture that I believe actually started before the Carter administration, before he became president. But the last president who actually talked about it and did it was Franklin Roosevelt. Anyhow, John Edwards continues.
And that's exactly what I will do as president. One of the last cases I handled, though, I represented a little girl who was really badly hurt on a swimming pool drain that was defective. And the company knew it was defective. And they hid it. Kids had been drowned and badly hurt on it. And they just hid the information because they were still selling. And so I sat with this family, and they were devastated. You know, really sweet people. And I said, we can help. We can do something about this. And I gave them hope. And then I walked into the courtroom and I gave that company hell. And that's exactly what we need again. We need a president who will give America hope and will give these powerful interests that are stopping America from getting what it needs hell. You know? I don't know if anybody here remembers that famous Harry Truman thing. Somebody said, oh, Harry, you're giving them hell. And he said, no, I'm just telling the truth and it feels like hell.
Yeah,
and
there you go. John Edwards in Iowa, and sometime in the last couple of days, the video's up over at democraticunderground.com. You can check it out. It's a YouTube and going viral, going fast. I mean, people are so hungry for that kind of rhetoric. And the progressives, the true progressives out there who are in Congress, in the House of Representatives and the Senate, the few in the Senate and the growing number in the House of Representatives, are getting such incredible support and finding it relatively easy to win elections compared to the DLC Democrats, the Republican light Democrats, who are having to pour huge amounts of money into campaigns. And now, in many cases, particularly in an effort being organized over at the Daily Kos, are finding themselves being challenged in the primaries. And I just, you know, I salute the folks who are carrying on those challenges. Anna in Greenlee, Colorado, listening on KKZN. Hey, Anna, welcome to the program.
Oh, hey, are you talking to me?
I am. You're on the air.
Well, I tell you what, I know I'm not going to get any better, so I'm not even going to ask.
Thank you, Anna.
I was wondering about, I was going to ask you if you think they're trying again to restore the Holy Roman Empire. That happened in the First World War, and in the Second World War, and the Third Reich, and now it may even be the Fourth Reich here, right? The Blue Dog Democrats are helping them along. And basically, there was a Democratic Congress in the 80s. They did the same thing then as they're doing now. And I fought them then all the way through. I tried to get a third party going. I got the propaganda that, oh, we can't have a third party. That's graven in stone. That's right here.
But the reality is that third parties have always ended up, at least at the national level, have always ended up harming the very issues that they're working for in the election. Now, on the other hand, they also brought those issues into sharp relief and in many cases put them on the agenda when they wouldn't have been there before.
So whatever happened, okay, you also mentioned the gabblers in Texas about history.
Yeah, I was just a joke, you know.
Yeah, but yeah. I was there. Yeah. And I mean, I remember, I'm from Oklahoma, but... Yeah, what they did was, what we always had before was history of white male wars.
Yep.
And then suddenly women got looked at, and African Americans got looked at, and they got put in these history books, but they were turned down by the gabblers in Texas. And also the propaganda rose all over the place that kids don't like to read history. It's boring.
Yeah. Well, this is you're absolutely right, Anna, and thank you for the call and for highlighting it. This is part of the ongoing war against against Americans understanding their own history. And it started during the Reagan administration with the purging of civics in our public schools, because those socialist teachers, those communist teachers, how do you know they're communist? Well, first of all, you poll them, and most of them are liberal. That's what happens when you get a college education. And beyond that, they're union members. They must be communists. Yeah. Jay in Connecticut. Hey, Jay.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call, Tom.
Sure.
I think the one worst thing that Ronald Reagan did was making a corporation taxable as a person. And I'd love to see John Edwards get in there and take that on.
Now, I'm missing something here, Jay. You know something I don't know. Tell me, what are you talking about here?
Didn't he roll back the taxes for corporations and say they were taxable as a person?
No, corporations still pay taxes as corporations. C corporations do. As sub S corporations, which is a separate category, is where, you know, like I, you know, if Louise and I own the company that owns this show, and so we have it as a sub S corporation. So any money that goes into that is taxed as if it was income to me. If there's money left over in the corporation at the end of the year, at my income tax rate. But that's, you know, small businesses. That's what, you know, small people do. A regular C corp, a traditional corporation, the rates are fairly low. I think the top corporate tax rate in the United States right now is around 35%, and the bottom corporate tax rate is 15%, as I recall. But what Reagan did was he crashed. I don't know what he did with the corporate tax, frankly, but I know that the personal income tax rates were 71% if you made over $3.2 million in today's dollars. And he dropped that down to, as I recall, 27%. And that started this massive hemorrhaging of the budget, and thus led to his having to double taxes on working people, you know, doubling the Social Security tax, and start borrowing that money into the general fund so that he could keep the country afloat. But the issue of corporations as persons is a whole separate issue. There's an entire website devoted to it off TomHartmann.com. I wrote a book about it called Unequal Protection. Just go over to TomHartmann.com and click on Corporate Power, and you'll see it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. Here we are speaking, 9.5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see here. Brian in Denver, Colorado. You want to set me straight on something, Brian?
Hi, Tom. No, I have listened to you for a long time, and I really agree with most of what you say. But some of the information about the AT&T breakup, I think you've got some erroneous background.
Okay.
And I say that because I was there.
Uh-huh.
I was involved with one of the law firms that was very much involved in the representation of one of the other parties to that process. And it was actually started by the Ford administration Justice Department in 74.
Right. I'm looking here at a New York Times piece, though. It says it was the Carter administration that pushed the antitrust suit against AT&T, a move that ultimately led to the breakup of the telecommunications giant.
Not totally accurate. What they did was not get in the way,
uh-huh.
which was very important,
yeah.
Obviously, because it wasn't concluded until 84 under Reagan, and the Reagan administration tried very much, very, very hard to stop it.
Mm.
But the Ford or the Carter administration was helpful in that they were very cooperative and did not try to stop it, didn't try to interfere, and did lend some lawyers to the process. But it was, believe it or not, almost entirely done by private lawyers.
Yeah.
And even though the company ended up becoming a pariah, it was mostly MCI. And I'm not trying to sell MCI. I'm just
saying, that's interesting.
That's the real background.
So MCI was seeing that they were dealing with the Death Star here, with a giant competitor who was in violation of the antitrust laws, and they went after them with the antitrust laws.
Fundamentally, yes.
Yeah. Okay, Brian, thank you very much. I appreciate the backstory.
Could I mention one other thing, which I did mention to your screener?
Sure.
And that has to do with the securitization issues.
The what issues? I'm sorry?
The mortgage mess, basically.
Right, yeah, okay.
And the reason that I bring that up is that I was there, too. The whole concept of securitizing mortgages and also credit cards really did start out being a good thing because it provided a lot of liquidity, and it depended upon the honesty of the mortgage companies and the strength of the regulator.
Right. For our listeners who don't understand what you're talking about, this is the practice of loaning people money and then, you know, loaning money to, say, 1,000 different people and then taking all those loans and bundling them together and saying, okay, we now have a product here that you can buy as an investment. This product will probably produce a 4 or 5 or 6 or 7% return on investment over, you know, a certain period of time. And you can buy a piece of it, basically. It's selling it like a stock, like a security.
Yeah.
And that practice made it a lot easier to raise money to sell to loan money to people. And the reverse is happening right now, is people are less and less willing to buy these packaged security, these packaged loans. The price of them is falling through the floor, and that's why all these banks are freaking out.
Yeah, and it's mostly because of the utter failure of regulation under the right wing.
That's right.
The structure actually makes a lot of sense and did provide a lot of liquidity for other loans, and the securitization or this process with mortgages is pretty old. It goes back to the 70s. A group of us developed the concept of securitizing credit cards, which also works unless the structure falls apart because the regulators fall apart.
Right. So we're back to the idea here, Brian, that capitalism works when it's regulated, as Adam Smith argued for in Wealth of Nations, and when it's unregulated, what you get are boom and bust disasters.
Worse, you get autocracies, and you get a
right.
Now, capitalism fundamentally has to be regulated to work.
Yeah.
And it needs to be fair and balanced. Oh God, I'm sorry I used those words.
That's okay, Brian. I got it. I appreciate your call. I want to get a few more people in here and into the program. But thank you very much for the call. It's much appreciated. Debbie in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Debbie.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I was really happy to hear you mention the DLC Howard Dean split. I find that a lot of my Democratic friends are not really aware of it, and I wish you could enlarge on that a little bit.
Okay.
I myself try to be an activist. I contact my representative and senators a lot, and I'm really worried about Nancy Pelosi. I wonder how many of these people are under the influence of the DLC. Recently, my congressman, Jay Inslee, voted for the Peru Free Trade Bill, and...
I'm surprised by that. I know Jay Inslee. He's a good guy. I didn't realize. Well,
yeah.
I have talked trade with him. I didn't know he was going to vote for it.
I wrote him right back and said, by now we should know better.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more, maybe another time if not now, how powerful is the DLC? Where exactly are they coming from? And what can we do about it?
The DLC, in my opinion, and you know, they will say, whatever they say. I mean, they have a website out there, and you know, Harold Ford Jr. is the head of it now. It used to be Rahm Emanuel.
Right.
The DLC will say that, you know, they're up to being the real Democrats. My opinion, frankly, is that the DLC is the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, and frankly, that's an oxymoron. The corporate wing of the Democratic Party, you know. The Democratic Party has traditionally been the party of the people, of workers, and to say that we've got a corporate wing, to me is you know, I can't, you know, an immediate absurd simile doesn't come to mind, but your metaphor, but you get it, and so Yeah, the DLC is, in my opinion, waning in influence, by the way. That's the good news. The bad news is they're still out there. Coming up tomorrow, Myron Abell is going to tell us that drilling offshore in Anwar would make us energy independent in 10 years. That should be interesting. Ian Carson is going to be here with Zoom, the global race to fuel the car of the future. That and the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartmann Program. Don't forget, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartmann archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.